Okay, firstly, wish everybody Hanukkah Sameach, a happy Hanukkah. Thank you. I don't think we could have chosen a better chapter to learn on Hanukkah than the description, or at least introductions to the description of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. I mean, the laning this week is all about the Hanukkah Sabayis, the dedication of the temple, of the Mishkan. And we learned last week the gaps between the dates of the building of the Mishkan to the building of the first temple, 480 years. And then from the first temple to the second temple, another 480 years. And there is this kind of seder, this symmetry, which is really quite astounding. And the Barbner that we saw last week, which really was so wonderful, that his comment was that this seder is obviously now not continued. The 480 years has not gone through to the third temple. And that's obviously going to be, please God, something which will happen, could happen at any time. It doesn't have to be according to that particular format. It was very exciting what he said, and kind of very uplifting. And of course, this week, Hanukkah, we talk a lot about the dedication of the original Mishkan, which we learned last week, according to the Barmina, was the highest madrega, the highest level of sanctity that existed, higher than the Temple of Solomon. Which I think was a bit of a surprise, certainly to me when I read it the first time. And obviously what we need to do now is to look a bit at the actual building of the Mishkan, of the Mikdash, of the actual temple. What I want to say is like this, that the nitty-gritty of chapters 6 and 7, of the building of it, I'm not actually going to go through. I'm cheating a bit, because what you'll see here is a very detailed account of the construction, how it was built, exactly what materials were used. I mean, it's extremely detailed. And what I want to do, instead of going through the detail here, which you can read quite easily, I would hope you have, take an English Bible, don't try and do it in the Hebrew. It's almost impossible, some of the words here. But if you take it from an English translation, you'll see exactly what's going on. Chapter 6 and 7. Chapter 6 is the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Chapter 7 is the building of Shlomo's palace. He had a special house which he had built. And chapter 8 is the tefillah, the dedication. And as I said last week, there is an issue right at the end of chapter 8 which we're going to deal with today. Before we get to that, I just want to show you this piece that I gave you. And it's taken from the Sefer Rav Ariel, who still teaches very much alive and well in Eretz Yisrael today. And he writes a bit about the whole approach that we should have to learning about the Mikdash. It ties up so wonderfully to Hanukkah. It ties up those who are doing the Daf Yomi, Gemara Zevachim, which is very trying for everyone who's plowing their way through the Daf Yomi. But again, you know, we spend a lot of time, certainly we try to spend a lot of time learning these things. And one of the things that struck me this time round, learning the Daf, is the fact that Chazal were writing about procedures in the temple, which would, for them were history. It's like we're writing about, I don't know, Elizabethan times, right? That for Chazal was what they were doing when they were writing in the Gemara about things that were going on in the temple, all the different laws of Pigel and what's Chuzlizmano, Chuzlimakama, if you've been in, connected to that Gemara. It's unbelievable. And yet they write it as if it's happening, as if it's current, if it's relevant. And I think this is something that we have to understand, that when we come across chapters like this, where we're dealing with the description and the understanding and the analysis of the building of the Beit HaMikdash, it should be, for us, the most relevant learning that we ever had. The famous story of the Chofetz Chaim, that he had a kola, which he started in Radin, which was known as Kola Kodshim. Kola Kodshim was very famous. He made a kola, which a very select group of people, this wasn't like kolot today, which seems to be for everybody and anybody. The kolot of the Chofetz Chaim was very, very select. And it was a number of people who were chosen to study the intricate laws of the Beit HaMikdash. Because for the Chofetz Chaim, this wasn't Hilchata L'Mashicha. It wasn't the law of Mashiach, it was the law for now. He was convinced that this was just about to happen. And we needed to know what to do. How do I shecht an animal? If we're going to have korbanot, there's a discussion about that, whether we will be. But let's assume there will be. And then how do I go about, you know, the building of it, the study of the Sefer Yecheskel with all the plans about how to build the third temple. All of this was very current, very relevant to him. And there was a group of people who studied this. My Rosh Yeshiva, I may have spoken about this before, Reb Zev Cohen, who passed away last year, was a Cohen born and bred in Yerushalayim, who came to Gateshead, who left Yerushalayim for many, many years. But really was a sabra. I used to speak to him in Ivrit. I mean, it was he was really a sort of in exile here, outside of Eretz Yisrael. And one of the traditions he had from his family was to have a long thumbnail. And his thumbnail was sharpened. It was ready for kmitza. Kmitza is what you do to the bird. You shech the bird, not with a knife, but you shech with your thumbnail. It gets very sharp and you draw it across the neck. And the bird is shechted when they used to bring doves or whatever for the various sacrifices. So, you know, for many people, this was practical halakha. It wasn't something for the future. It wasn't something that they're going to dream about. It was something that they were literally living every single day. And again, I seem to be sort of advertising the Israeli tourist board. But when you go to Israel, if you haven't been to the Museum of the Mikdash, the phenomenal museum of the recreation of the Caliph, the vessels of the temple, then you're really missing something. It's very easy to find. It's in the old city, the Jewish quarter. If you just sort of go to Yeshivat HaKotel and you come out of Yeshivat HaKotel, go down that road, Rehov, Orachaim, I think it is, and it's literally over there on the right. You can't miss it, and it's so uplifting to go there. There's a rabbi there called Rabbi Richman, who is really a wonderful guy, originally from the States, and I think, you know, just to go speak to him and to hear his enthusiasm for the Mikdash is really very exciting. So, again, I'm sort of embellishing this because even though we're not going to go through these psukim, I'm leaving them for you to read, but the whole concept of actually studying this is really extremely important. Yeah.
More practical, if not idealistic, the Chafetz Chaim established his yeshiva so that the laws of Kutchev would not be forgotten.
Correct. And not only that, but he wrote a commentary on Torah Kohanim. He wrote a commentary on the Sefer Vayikra. And he was ready to go to Eretz Yisrael. The famous story was that he made an announcement one Shabbos that he's moving to Israel. Right? They prepared a house for him in Petah Tikva, the Chofetz Chaim. He died in 1933 in Poland. And this was like two or three years, maybe a few years before that. I think the end of the 20s. He was preparing to go to Israel. A very old man already. But he was preparing to go. And it didn't work out. His wife got sick, and then I think eventually she died. And he just couldn't go. And he asked him, Rebbe, what happened? You know, you were so sort of determined to go to Israel. And he said it was the first time in his life he hadn't said the words B'li Neder. Very interesting. He said, I'm going to Israel. He didn't say the word B'li Neder. And he was convinced that that was part of the reason why eventually it just did not work out for him to go. And of course they asked him, well, who are you leaving behind? You're the father of Polish Jewry. So he said, you've got Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman was the great Rosh Yeshiva in Branovich, the student of the Chofetz Chaim, who sort of stayed behind. And I quote from Rabbi Bernstein from Zichron Evroch of London. He told a wonderful story. He met a Talmud of the Chofetz Chaim, who was a Poshta Balabos in Yerushalayim, man who was well into his 90s, and he met him, and you know, he met him in the street, and he knew who he was, and he said to him, look, I've got to ask you a question. He said, you were a student of the Chofetz Chaim. Rabbi Chanan was a student. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, the great Rosh Yeshiva, was a student of the Chofetz Chaim. What happened? You became a Balabos, and he became this great Rosh Yeshiva. So he said the following. He said, when the Chofetz Chaim spoke, he said, I listened. He said, when the Chofetz Chaim spoke, Rabbi Chanan shook. He was shaking because he was so in awe of the Rebbe. When the Rebbe spoke, that's why he became the Rosh Yeshiva. I just became a Balabos, he said. And it's a wonderful story. You know, when you're living in such awe of a person like that. And of course, those who went to YU, I think if you knew Rabbi Sachs, is it Mendel Sachs, who was the son-in-law, right? The son-in-law of the Chofetz Chaim. You know, there is a connection there. So without further ado, I just want to talk a little bit about this page in front of you, and then talk about the conundrum of Yom Kippur, and I think hopefully that will cover it for today. Listen to this. Yeah, there you go. Haged et Beit Yisrael et Abayit, right? It's quoting a pasuk. This, again, as I said, is from Rav Ariel, a contemporary writer on Tanakh, who teaches in the north of Israel. Beit HaMikdash hu libam shel Yisrael. The Beit HaMikdash is the heart of Israel. All right, and I'm very amiss, by the way. I wanted to dedicate the shir this week. I usually dedicate it to someone who's no longer with us, but this week I want to dedicate it to my granddaughter, who's going to be Bat Mitzvah. Please go on in a month's time. Shira Nechama Levitt, who lives in Florida, is wonderful. to believe that, you know, I've got a 12-year-old granddaughter, that really is quite stirring thought. But Mirtz Hashem, we look forward to the Simcha, which will be during the vacations, so I just wanted to share that. Alright, Beit HaMikdash hu libam shel Yisrael, back to the text. The Beit HaMikdash is the heart of Israel. Ubo mitmatzim kisufen. This is where the longing of the Jewish people is concentrated. This is the place which we long for, as we should do even to this very day. Afilu l'tochnit abayit, he says, even for the construction of the house, the plan, yesh erech rav, there is a very great value, l'limudeo yesh mashmud rabbah, a tremendous meaning in studying it. Hein be'et tifarto, binyano, whether it's standing and it's in front of us. Ve'hein b'churbano, whether it's destroyed. Habayit masamel b'tzurato. What does the temple signify? It signifies in its form, et mivneh ha'ideali, good Hebrew word there, the ideal formation, shel umah, of the nation, u'dveikuta b'elohea, and its closeness to God. V'tavnit zu, and this formation, mekayemet b'tocha et hashrat hashchina. This is what contains the divine presence. Avos shinun tzurat habayit chashuv gam la'achar churban. He says, nowadays, we're after the churban. But you know what? It's still important to learn this. Kafi shemadgish zot Yechezkel anavi, ha'masartet et tmunat habayit latid lavod. As Yechezkel, the prophet, in the book of Ezekiel, towards the end, he gives you the plans for the temple in the future. Good evening. And this is something which I think is really important. And this pasuk, which he quotes over here, which is really special, the last line of that quotation, the third line, where he says, v'katam, he's going to write down all the details of the third temple, and we have to guard it. And he says that all the laws, and we have to do them. There is an interesting problem with the book of Yechezkel that there are many discrepancies between the laws that he quotes in the book and what is mentioned in the Torah. He talks about Kohenim doing certain things which are not mentioned in the Torah. So that's a whole study by itself. If we ever get to the book of Yechezkel, that's something to go into. But Mirtz Hashem, that's for another time. So after that heavy print, Birur Tzurat Abayit Kayom Eino Hazaya V'Chazon Liyamim Achirim Ele Yesh Bo Kzeh Koach La'Avi L'Akshamat Binyano. This is a very precious idea that when we study this and we put effort into reading about it, it can bring about the Hakshama, the realization of the building of it. Limud Zeh Dochef Libechina Daktakinit. Basically, what happens is that we are, as it were, pushing away the present with all of the problems that we have. And looking at the temple and everything to do with it, it gives us a sense of shame. Because nowadays we can't fulfill the challenge of actually building it. And this is, again, a whole historical situation which is very fascinating. There was a tshuva responsa in 1862 of the Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer of Presburg. And they wrote him from Eretz Yisrael, and they said that we are now beginning the new Yishuv. We're returning to Israel, the Chovei Tzion, and all of the people connected, and they wanted to bring Korban Pesach. And they wanted to do it on the Har Habayit. And Rav Moshe Sofer writes back in the Tshuva Chassam Sofer, which is such a wonderful tshuva. He says, in theory, in principle, halachically, you can do it. He says, the problem is, and how this is a problem today even more so, the problem is that the Arabs won't let you do it. They won't let you go even on to the Har Habayit, let alone to start bringing Korbanot. And this was 150 years ago. So today, this is the issue. The issue is that as soon, remember, when Sharon went on to walk on the Har Habayit, the next thing you know, you've got on your hands, you've got civil war, you've got a war going on. And this is the sort of mindset, unfortunately, there is talk at the moment about even delegitimizing our connection to the Kotel. That's why it's even more important what we're doing this evening. Just to remind ourselves of our connection to this holy place, to understand what it is, what it means, the symbolism of it. As we're reading this on Hanukkah, as I said, it fits in so beautifully what we're doing at the moment. We're reading about the Mishkan on Hanukkah, and here in chapters 6, 7, and 8, we're reading about the dedication, the building, and the dedication of the temple in Jerusalem. What more fitting item could we have in order to remind ourselves of what Hanukkah is really all about? the rededication, please go once again, we hope, of the Beit HaMikdash. I mean, I couldn't have picked a better subject for this evening. I was thinking about that on driving over here. It really sort of hit me. We're on the third line of the paragraph that we're reading. He mazarzeret et ha-tshuva. It says when you learn these things, it brings you to tshuva. You want it to be. Ha-mevi'o le-tikun ha-am. When it brings the repair of the nation. V'achanato likrat etgarei atid. And meeting the challenges of the future. Limud ze goreim la-atakat tachlit ha-chayim min ha-oveh. And all our purpose in life gets transferred from the present. We look forward to the building in the future. To learn this is like a drug of life, which can bring us to redemption. That's why the Chofetz Chaim was so keen on learning this stuff, because he realized this is a way to push things forward, to push things to the future. Becomes a real item. The next paragraph he quotes from the Rabbeinu Bachya. I just want you to see at the bottom here. I know it's very small. It's a note 41. And he just gives you some of the symbolism of what the temple is about. And of course, this week when we read the Parsha and the Siyim, it's the same issue. They bring the same korbanot every single day. Whatever tribe it is, it's the same offering. And this is a big question. What's going on? They're bringing the same thing over and over again, and the Torah doesn't repeat words, then why does it repeat the korban over again and over again? As we read today, tomorrow, we've been reading the whole week. It's very odd. And of course, the answer is given. All the Mefarshim say that it might have, on the outside, looked the same, but each tribe had a different kavanah, a different intention of what it was really about. And if you look in the Ramban on that particular parsha, he gives you some examples of that. So really, what it's about is not the external feature, but what is behind the scene. What is the deeper meaning of the animals that were being brought, that we read about this week, or this description over here of the temple, what is really going on behind the scene? When you walked into that building and you had this experience of coming face to face with Hashem, with Har Sinai, apparently it was the experience of really revisiting Mount Sinai all over again. What exactly would you think of? What exactly would go through your mind? What would it be all about? What would be that experience? Now, for some, going to the Kotel, it sort of does it for you. But perfectly honest, I don't know. I've done it there, and it's a very inspiring place to be. But it's not the temple. It really isn't. I always quote Nachum Segal from the radio show. He says, the Kotel is the second most important place in the Jewish world. He says, the first most important place in the Jewish world is the Har HaBayit. He says, the place we can't go near. We can't go in there. Yeah.
We can go on Har HaBayit. There are small groups,
and it's only very limited. And have you done it?
Actually, I'm going to be there in February, with Rosh Hashanah.
Right.
I was hoping to do it.
Good.
But my daughter said, can she go? Can women go?
Yeah, I don't think they're letting women go. And there's a whole issue because you've got to do mikveh beforehand. And it's a lot of preparation. It's a complicated business. I'm not sure if they're taking women there, you know, for halachi reasons. There may be restrictions, and even to take the men up there is already a controversial move. But I know Rabbi Goren mapped out the places you could go.
From a
halachi point of view,
to
a halachi.
When I went on the Temple Mount, but they had services, so they didn't allow us in.
Yeah. That's it. It's also you've got to go at the right time, and it's small groups, and it's a Rosh Yeshiva, one of the Rabboni, I think, from Bet El, who's organizing.
Oh,
you went in the old days, yeah.
77, I was in Israel.
Yeah, you went in. That's already the days when it wasn't so sort of controversial, yeah.
You know, I did one of these tours with Daniel Loria from
Atari. Yeah, I know that.
We went into the Shukatoni, the Canton Market.
Yeah.
That's right in the, you walk through it.
Yeah.
At the end, there's steps up to the...
To the Arabite, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he looked like, you know, you don't go on these steps.
He told you not to even go.
Well, his expression told me.
Yeah.
And then I saw a couple of the Arab from the Lanka also coming, like,
you don't want to start anything.
I didn't want to start anything.
Yeah. It's frustrating because, you know, there shouldn't be an issue with this. I remember when I first did the tunnel tours, which by the Kotel, there was a woman, wonderful guy, the sister of one of the Chavrei Knesset, I've forgotten her name, Rivka, but I've forgotten her surname. But she said that the terrible thing for us is that, she says, Ganavim Balaila, he says, we're like thieves in the night, having to do this under the, you know, under the cover of dark, literally. They're not allowing us access the way that they should be. And of course now, there is tremendous propaganda going on trying to delegitimize our whole connection to this, right? You can read in the papers today. And that's why, you know, we should be sitting learning this, because it's our way of saying, you know, we know the connection, we will never deny the connection, Chas v'Shalom, and on the contrary, you know, it's about time that the world woke up and realized this is something very, very special. If they only knew what building the temple would bring to the peace of the world and to the harmony of the world. I mean, it just defies the imagination what the world could be like if they actually built this building all over again. But that's a difficult subject. That's a difficult one to sell. Look at this. I just want to show you very quickly a bit of the symbolism before we start to talk a little bit about Yom Kippur. This is note 41 at the bottom. Hatefisah symbolic. This is all good Hebrew. The symbolism. Ha simliit. He achat adrachim ikariot. It's really one of the ways of studying this, the whole story of how it was built. Ayena barbeno perichet hamevi letavnit hamikdash peirushim rabim. The barbeno brings a whole bunch of commentaries to explain how the temple was built. Mehem shiva peirush shel hachmei omot. He even quotes some non-Jewish sources, which he does very often. Shenismach adat chachmei amenu, which are relying on the wisdom of the rabbis. And for instance, Habayit Moreh al Hamatziyut Bichlaluteh, the temple is a representation of the whole world, of the whole universe, he says. Kodesh HaKodeshim, what is the Holy of Holies? Moreh al Olam Hamalachim, it's the world of angels, because it's obviously a very unique, very holy place. And he says that symbolized the Zehayu Shama Kruvim. That's why you had the cherubs there, which are essentially physical representation of a malach, of an angel. That's the kruvim. Ha-heichal, the room which was outside the Holy of Holies, meid al olam ha-galgalim. That refers, really, this literally means the world of wheels, but it basically means the whole solar system that we're in. Ulezeh ha-yushama ha-menorah, and that's the idea of the menorah being there. Ha-sheba shiva kochvei leket, which had seven branches, which represent the seven planets which they knew about. We actually know about a few more planets. But essentially, and this goes back into Talmud and into Kabbalistic writing as well. What is the Shulchan? What is the table? Asher alav shtei misrei chalot, on which there were 12 loaves of bread. He says, haromez el galgal hamazalot. That refers to the whole cycle of the mazal. Right, we say Mazel Tov, we use that phrase. The zodiac, the forces within the world, within the universe, which make the world go around, if that's the way to describe it. I'm not going to go into Mazalot now, but that's a whole discussion for another time. What is the Chatzer, the courtyard? Remez or Lama Shafel Azer, that's a symbol of this world, which is very lowly. Ulechein, he says, Hayaba Mizbech HaOla. That's why you only had an altar in the courtyard, which was to offer up offerings which were completely burnt. Hamoreh alahoveh v'efseh, which is the idea that in this world, really, everything's going to go up in flames. Everything's going to be here, and then it'll be gone, right? You're here today, as they say, and gone tomorrow. V'kiyor, and what about the basin which they wash their feet? Hamoreh al taharat maaseh adam, that's the idea of trying to purify your actions in this world. That's why the basin was outside. Ulezeh lo hayu b'chatzeh klei zahav klal, there was no golden vessels out there at all in the courtyard. Ki im nechoshet, only brass. And of course that is a lower metal, it's a sign more of the lowly world than of the higher worlds. I mean, all of this is unbelievable. And this is what you're supposed to think about, not only, I suppose, when you walk into the temple, but one would like to think that a kind of shadow of this might cross your mind when you walk into shul. When you walk into shul and you see certain symbols and the Aron HaKodesh and think about the Kodesh Kodshim and the Olam HaMalachim and the fact that this was a representation, should be of the angels and whatever, you know, it turns shul into a different experience, which is not a bad thing. And he says the Abarbanel goes in for more Yidiot Amukot, he says. He goes in for even something deeper than this. And, you know, at the bottom of the page, he loses me completely because he becomes Kabbalistic, and he says that the numbers of all the measurements of the building of the temple were in numbers of tens. It's 20 amos or 30 amos or 50 or whatever it is. And he says, because that's a remes to the Eses Sfirot, the 10 emanations of God, which are essentially the Sfirot. We mention them in Kabbalistic terms. Those of you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, I'm not quite sure what I'm talking about myself. But the idea is that this is, a deeper awareness when you go into the Beit HaMikdash of what essentially godliness is about, the idea how God manifests himself in this world through the Sfirot, which some of you will recognize the language of if you say that long tefillah at the end of the counting of the Omer, the Sfiras Omer. There's a Rabbonu Shel Olam at the end, which is very Kabbalistic. A lot of people don't say it because of that. All I can say is that, you know, when you see this, it just blows the mind. The idea is that, again, seeing and understanding the study of what we're doing here, what we're trying to do here, at least in the way of introduction, is the idea of really coming to grips with a place, with a concept, with an experience which is just very difficult to describe, but must have been incredibly uplifting, incredible. And, you know, for the 40 years of Shlomo, his kingship, after he built this place, the whole way that the system worked, and again, please go to the tunnels if you're in Israel soon. Go, if you haven't done it, go and see. They've got models there to show you how the palace was, his palace was connected to the Beit HaMikdash, and it shows you exactly the walkways and bridges, and it's an unbelievable connection. All of this is brought to life. You know, it's very hard for me to sort of to go through this, and it really, I don't know whether it would be productive. You know, as I said, please read it. But what I would say to you is, when you're actually there in Israel, you know, and you're in facing the model of this whole description here, then of course it becomes a different parsha, a different experience. What I want to do very briefly, as I said last week, is to go right to the end of chapter 8. And to look at the last few psukim, which I mentioned to you last week, and to give you some indication of what's going on here. After the temple is dedicated, and after the palace of Shlomo is built, and everything that happens, which is above and beyond anything that we can begin to understand, the description of the celebration is extremely challenging. And this is something I wanted to show you. It's verse 65. In the red book, page 102. In the blue book, 69, page 69. Pasuk Samach Hei. Vayah Shlomo ba'et ahi. This is right at the end, after he dedicates the temple. And as I said, we read Shlomo's dedication. I think, I said last week on Pesach, I don't think so. I think it's on Sukkot. If I'm not mistaken, 1.5 Torahs, because this is happening over Sukkot. Vayah Shlomo ba'et ahi et achag. Shlomo made the chag, which refers to the chag of Sukkot. All the Jews were with him, Kahal, Gadol, big congregation, Milavo, Chamat, and Nacham Mitzrayim, really stretching from one end of Israel to the other, if that's the way to describe it, literally thousands, if not millions. Lifnei Hashem Elokeinu, Shivat Yomim, Shivat Yomim. It started off as 7 days of dedication of the temple, the Shivat Yomim, and then 7 days of Chag of Sukkot. So you had altogether Abbas Yom, 14 days from beginning to end. And of course, when did it all happen? Bayom Hashmini, on the 8th day of the second period. In other words, after the 14 days were up, there was a 15th day, Shilach et ha'am, he sent the people away. And this is referring to Shmini Atzeret. Not that the people left. The people didn't leave till the day after, as I said last week, Simchat Torah. We know this from Divrei Hayamim, the description in another book of the Bible, which gives us the exact dates. But on Shmini Atzeret, they took their leave of Shlomo, and then they went on Simchas Torah, which is not a chag in Israel, obviously. It's a regular day. They started going home. The thousands and thousands of people that had celebrated. And vayivorchu et ha-melech, they blessed the king, vayechol aleihem. They went home, smechim v'tovilev, very happy, with a fullness of heart, akol tova, for all the goodness she'asah Hashem le-David avdo, v'l'Yisrael amo, which God had done for David and for Israel. Very interesting. Always goes back to David. Yeah.
If these two 7-day periods are consecutive,
yeah,
the first 7 is going to be during Yom Kippur.
Excellent. And that is the big problem. The big problem is that according to this numbering system, and everybody says this, they must have done the dedication of the temple, started it on the 8th of Tishrei. Because you go 8 and 7 is 15 and 7 is 22, that gets you to the end of Sukkot. They were partying right through the first 7 days from the 8th of Tishrei to the 15th till Sukkot, meaning Yom Kippur inclusive. This is where I want to give you the second handout for the evening and show you that there is something exactly, except that I don't seem to have it. No, we'll see. That's one suggestion, but it's not. It seems to be that it doesn't work like that. If you just take a couple of these, what I've done is just produced the redact. You've actually got it in, many of you have it in the safer. I think I'll just sort of spread them around. The handout that you have is just the redact, which deals with this issue of Yom Kippur. Because what it seems that the way it's expressed over here is that the, how should we say, the dedication took place during Yom Kippur. And the big question is, what happened? What exactly was the format of this particular event? Let me see if I've got my copy here. Just 1 second, yeah. And let me just show this to you very quickly. Says the Radak, Et Achag. All right, and it's I put it in bigger print because reading it from the regular Mikra Gedolot is very small. So have a look at this page. Hachag, Hanukkah Hamikdash, Korei Gam Kein Chag. So the celebration, not only the Chag is the name of Sukkot, but it's also the dedication of the temple. Lefi Shaita Smucha LeChag HaSukkot, because it ran into Sukkot. Sukkot was a continuation of the 7 days, it was another 7 days after the dedication of the temple. V'asu shivat yimei Chanukah, interesting word, they made 7 days of dedication, v'shivat yimei Chag HaSukkot, and 7 days of Sukkot. V'omer abas hayom, so why then does he do the math and say 14 days? Can't we add up? We can do it ourselves. So he says, Lodia, to tell you, ki smuchimoy, they followed on, one after the other. This is answering Eliot's point. Lo haya hefresh b'neim, no interruption. Ubayom ha-shmini, on the 8th day, meaning Shmini Atzeret, sha'omer shalach et ha'am, where it says, shilach adam, they send the people away, who is Shmini Atzeret? That is Shmini Atzeret. V'lo nuchal lefareish, ki shivat yimei Chanukah hayu achar shivat yimei Sukkot. You can't say that it was the other way around, that they did Sukkot first, and then 7 days of celebration. It doesn't work. V'yom ha-shmini, shmini l'chanukah, and the 8th day is the 8th day of the period of dedication. He says, no. Sharei omer b'divrei ha-yomim, because in divrei ha-yomim, he says clearly, u'b'yom esrim u'shlosha l'chodesh, the 23rd of Tishrei, ha-shavi of the 7th month, shilach et ha-am, he sent the people away. So, there's no question about it. They had 7 days of partying, as it were, dedication, and then 7 days of sukkahs. Now, here comes the bombshell. V'im toma, yom shmini atzeret, ein elechaf bet l'chodesh. Oh, sorry. So that's just a technical problem. Just go down where you've got underlined. Lefisha Chag will be Yom Esrim Shlosha Lachodesh, Chazur Venot LeRashut, etc., etc. Now, the middle of the line which begins with the word Rashut. V'holchu La'aleh, be Afal Pi. Here comes the bombshell. Even though Shasu Shivat Yimei Chanukah Kodim Chag Asukot. They obviously dedicated the temple 7 days before Sukkot. V'yom HaKippurim b'chlalam. Eliyahu's question is Yom Kippur. If it's Yom Kippur, what's going on here? V'efshar sh'oto yom, so says the Radak, you know what? For that day, lo achlu, they didn't eat. Now, as I said last week, I can't believe in the middle of all the celebration and the dancing and everything else, the Gabbai comes in and bangs on the table and says, Bosa, Kol Nidre, I don't believe for 1 second that they stopped partying. It's impossible. They could never have done it. Who would be brave enough to stop the party? So even though the suggestion is that they kept Yom Kippur, you can see that the Radak is comfortable with saying it from the point of view that, you know, it's Yom Kippur. But look, I'll just go down a few lines. We're just looking at the time where it's underlined. Avam. Raboteinu Zal, it's sort of almost in the middle of this section. Underline. Aval Raboteinu Zal, the rabbis say, Omru, ki achlu oto Yom Kippur. They ate on Yom Kippur. Wow. And you'll say to me, wait a minute, what sort of dedication is Mitzvah Bo Bavera? You know, this is a mitzvah, but it's a sin over here, yeah.
Obviously, whoever, who picked the time? time to celebrate Shlomo, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He knew what he was doing.
Correct. We're going to talk about that. Hold that thought, because I'm going to say something. On those lines, I'm going to suggest something which is kind of radical, but I think it might work. We'll see. See in a second. But let's just see how the Radak deals with this. He says, you know what? He wanted to suggest that they stop partying, but he says the rabbis say that they did party. Ki bichlal yemei asimcha haya, it was part of the 7 days. And then he brings a whole limud from the dedication of the Mishkan, which we're reading at the moment on Chanukah, and he proves that there was a dedication. Part of it took place on Shabbos, because remember, it was 12 days of dedication. It must have gone through a Shabbat. And certain korbanot were offered on the Shabbos, which normally would not be offered. So he wants to say that they took a proof from there, that when it comes to dedication of the building of the Mishkan, eventually of the temple, there were certain allowances, things that could be done on the holy day, which would normally not be done on a regular basis. So the suggestion is that Yom Kippur was in fact cancelled for that particular year. This is radical. It's absolutely radical. What I want to just show you is at the bottom here, what he says, which is something so beautiful. He says, and it's again the underlining, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines at the bottom. I'll tell you my suggestion about this in a minute. He says, Val kolze, after all of what we've just spoken about, the whole preparation and the dedication, and the fact that they were partying during Yom Kippur, and that everything took place in such an organized way, however you understand what they were doing on that Yom Kippur, he says after that, holchul oleim, they went home, smechim v'tuvele, they were full of joy. What? And he says, ubedivrei hayamim, and if you look in the book of Chronicles, divrei hayamim, omer kol hatova, for the goodness asher asah Hashem leDavid, Shlomo Israel, it adds David and Shlomo. In our pasuk, we know it just said Le David Uli Israel. It doesn't say Shlomo. In Divrei Hayamim, it mentions David and Shlomo and Israel Imo and Israel. And Rabbeinu Zal Dorshu Le David Avdo. What does it mean that he did good to David? He says the following. Listen to this. This is unbelievable. Ki b'sha'a shebikesh Shlomo. Shlomo wanted to bring the ark into the Holy of Holies, as it is supposed to be. What happened? Some people may know this. The gates were shut. Couldn't open up the entrance to the Kodesh Kodshim. Whatever it was shut tight. So what did he say? There's a wonderful choral piece, which I think we heard a few weeks ago. It's a fabulous piece. And I can just see them all singing this. This time he says that Shlomo started up by saying, open, raise your gates. O gates, raise your head. In other words, open up the gates. Shlomo was not answered. But Kivan Sha'amar, once he said, Al Tashay Pnei Meshichecha, do not turn away from the anointed one, from David. Zachra lechaste David, then it was remembered at that moment the deeds of David, avdecha, your servant. Oh, that's the pasuk, right? Remember the deeds of David, your servant. Miyad ne'na, he was answered immediately. And the gates opened and the ark could go in. Listen to his conclusion there. It's unreal. And it's so beautiful. V'yedu kol Yisrael, v'yodu kol Yisrael, everybody knew. Shemochal HaKadosh Baruch Hu leDavid. Aloto Avon. What sin are we referring to?
Bathsheba.
At that point, when in David's merit, the ark could be taken back into the Holy of Holies, that was a sign from heaven that finally David had been forgiven. He's already dead. We know that he tried. Remember we said at the beginning of our learning that he was trying to tshuva, and he died, and he wasn't. Was he really sure that he did? We now have confirmation at the opening of the dedication of the temple that his sin was forgiven. This is breathtaking. It's such a wonderful sort of ties up that loose end which we were sort of having to deal with at the beginning of the Book of Kings, and this is where it gets kind of finished. And b'zeh asher asah Hashem leDavid avdo. And this is why it says that this was such a great thing, not only for Shlomo, not only for Israel, but for David. It was the ultimate expression of forgiveness. If God is going to open up the gates on behalf of David to let the ark go into the Holy of Holies, that is the ultimate statement from God that David is forgiven. I'm going to put this on just something to think about. This is just a breathtaking comment in itself.
Still doesn't answer the question about Yom Kippur.
Right, we're going to say something. I'm going to say the following. Now, here comes something which I think is so radical that I'm not even sure if I'm going to switch off the tape, but I won't. I'll let it go on the record. The point is like that. I really believe it's possible. We said in a few weeks ago, we said this and kept repeating this, that there is a massive difference between Shlomo's way of serving God and David. David was the man who basically was in outer space. He was somebody who, you know, Susha and Roshecha. I mean, he's dreaming about the gates of heaven. He's dreaming about the, as they say, the Shivarakim. He's already in the seventh heaven. And his whole life is one continual connection to God. And read the Tehillim and you'll see again and again, I'm in trouble, the Roshoim are around, and only through you, Hashem, you'll save me. Ovi v'imi azavuni, we said in the Dovah Shemuri, my father, my mother forsaken me. V'Hashem yasveni, God will bring me in. God will gather me. God will save me. And this is David. The whole of David's life is about connection to God. When it comes to Shlomo HaMelech, we'll talk about a different, as you say in English, different kettle of fish. Shlomo HaMelech, as we said, was someone who, he took the whole concept in a different way. David is described in Kabbalistic terms, itaruta delela. He goes from the top down. He basically aims for heaven. David is a man of Tehillim. The Gemara says one Tehillim of David, as we mentioned this, is greater than all of the Korbanot of Shlomo. Shlomo can offer 1,000 sacrifices, and one Tehillim is holier. And the reason is because David is coming from a different perspective. He's already got 2 feet in heaven. He's already up there. Shlomo has got a different derech. Shlomo is much more a man who wants to develop this world, the world around him, the world of material experience, material existence. So what does Shlomo do? He builds a building, and you'll see the descriptions of all this of the building when you read this through for yourselves, of magnificent opulence. You can't begin to imagine how magnificent the building was, overlaid with gold, and when you came in, and the height, and the presentation of everything is just above and beyond. And everything that Shlomo did, everything that he was connected to, was elevating itaruta de la tata, taking something from the grassroots and making it holy, trying to bring it up. Now, I'm going to suggest that what happened on this Yom Kippur is something which for Shlomo Melech was kind of obvious, but for everybody else was probably not obvious. What happened was that normally, what is Yom Kippur about? Yom Kippur is about the 24 hours, 25 hours, when we deny our physical existence, as it were. We put it on hold, we don't eat, we have all the inuim, all the afflictions, and by the end of Yom Kippur, you're supposed to feel a connection to God. Hashem Elokim, Hashem Elokim, we say at the end. And this is the whole idea of Yom Kippur, is to achieve a closeness to God by denying the physical realm. Think about what Shlomo would have done on this Yom Kippur. Shlomo on this Yom Kippur, when they were opening up the Mikdash, and he is about elevating the physical to become become spiritual, he would have taken that Seudas Yom Kippur, and for them it was as if they were fasting. They ate, they drank, they rejoiced. It was like Simchas Torah like you've never seen in your life. Unbelievable stuff. And all of this was bringing them so close to God that even though it was being done in exactly the opposite way to Yom Kippur has been done ever since, you know what? It achieved the same goal, probably even a greater goal. It achieved that closeness, that elevation of taking the grassroots and making it holy. And I really believe that's what happened. I can't remotely come to terms with the concept in the middle of all of this that the Shabbos calling out Kol Nidre and everybody's stopping down. It can't be. But what I think can happen is that they were so imbued with a sense of holiness. I've mentioned this before. The idea when you eat to say that not only the bracha, hopefully that we do say, but just to think of the blessing of the food that we're being presented with. Lichvod Shabbat, I mentioned the story a few weeks ago, the Rebbe that I once witnessed, who every mouthful covered Shabbos. He ate for the sake of Shabbos. It's something to see. When somebody does that, and it's not done in order to score points and to sort of, you know, make a kind of impression. He really lived it. This rabbi that I remember seeing many years ago, it was unreal. And you see rebbes like that, and you go to a Tish, go to Borough Park, or go in there to Israel, you'll see the rebbes, you know, some of them really sort of live this life. They elevate whatever they can from the material world to make it holy. And I really believe that's what happened here. That Shlomo in his derech, and it's Shlomo's derech, David could never have handled this. David could never have done this. But Shlomo took the whole Yom Kippur experience and turned it on his head. Everybody was partying, but you know what? that achieved such a closeness to God that for them, that Yom Kippur was, by eating, by drinking, by doing everything that they did, they became even closer to God. That to them, that in those days was what Yom Kippur hopefully is for us today. And I think that that is a kind of, as I said, a radical suggestion, but it may work. Yeah.
The litmus test would be, in Binyan Beis HaMikdash the third,
yeah,
will we be able to eat on Yom Kippur?
Will we be able to eat on Yom Kippur?
I believe that's ish about that.
Yeah.
Well,
what happened to Yom Kippur? That's a very good question, and I'm not going to comment because I really don't know. As I said over here, Shlomo HaMelech, he exhibits this Shir HaShirim. I'm just going to say one word about Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim, which is one of the famous books, one of the songs of songs, right? Which everybody sort of wonders about, and Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, what are you wondering about? They wanted to keep it out of the Bible, and Rabbi Akiva says, it's Kodesh Kodshim. It's the Holy of Holies. So everybody asks the question, what do you mean Holy of Holies? So everybody says, and again, if you look in the Askel translation, they go for the Nimshal, the meaning that the love that is expressed in Shir HaShirim is the love between God and the Jewish people. And of course, what I may have mentioned this before, that I really find what Askel did, and many rabbis have commented on this, actually wrong. Because what they did is ignored the love story. Why is the love story so important? They didn't even write about it in the translation. And the reason why it's important is because what do we relate to when we say we love God? We say the pasuk twice a day, Ahavta Hashem Elokecha, we've got to love God. How can I love something that is invisible? It's difficult. It's not difficult, it's impossible. I can love, you know, I can feel connection to something that I can see, to a person, or to, you know, I love steak, so I can, if that's the way to describe it. But to God, you know, how do I have that connection? So the answer is, says Shlomo HaMelech, you're going to have to develop the sense of love of God through the love between man and wife. That concept of being close, of feeling that closeness, that ahava, of the physical love that one can experience in this world, can then give you a slight indication of what it really means to come and love God. And the Rambam says it, right at the end of Hilchot Tshuva, the Rambam says this, that the idea is that coming to love God is through the physical world. And this is Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo took the physical world, the earthiness of Shir HaShirim is quite shocking, right? It's erotic, it's very, very sort of powerful. But Shlomo understood that that is the human experience. We will understand it like that. And then we feel those feelings of connection in the physical description that he gives. And then you know what? It becomes spiritual. That's Shlomo HaMelech. He's taking the physical and he's always elevating it to something holy. And that's Yom Kippur, and that's Shir HaShirim, and I think that was Shlomo's, unfortunately, that was Shlomo's downfall. Shlomo's downfall was that he allowed himself this indulgence in the physical world, and you know what? There's got to be limits. There's got to be gevulim, as they say. There's got to be boundaries. And what Shlomo did, instead of the boundaries that the Torah sets up, 18 wives and whatever number of horses, like Yabelo Susim, he went extreme. We saw last week. He had thousands of horses, tens of thousands, and 1,000 wives, or 700 wives, 300 concubines, as it says. And, you know, everything about that is very, very challenging. Shlomo was always pushing the envelope to make the experience, the material experience, as large as he could, so that it would then become even more. He would generate even more holiness by making that even more holy, raising it to a spiritual level from the material world. So he went over and above what the Torah allows. And he said for himself, this was something that he felt that he could allow. Why did he do this? He also, I suppose, made a lesson of everybody else. He wanted to show everybody, I can handle it, but you should know that you're the next king must not do this because I can do it, and you'll see that if you try it, you'll fail. I can do it and succeed because I'm Shlomo and my experience and everything about my life, and I can do this, and of course every other king mustn't do this. And the problem was, you don't play around with these things as Shlomo did, and as they say in the classics, it backfired on him. Very, very severely. As Mirza Shem will see, when we start learning again, please God, after the break, the 25th of January, I think, is the next year, when we'll see Mirza Shem from chapter 9, down through chapter 11, how the things really, unfortunately, descend, they go downhill, because Shlomo was, in fact, maybe a bit too adventurous. It's really quite something. But I hope I gave you some idea about the Yom Kippur thing. It's really an unbelievable concept. Final comment.
But when he wrote Kohelet, did he realize by that time?
That was at the end of his life, yeah.
He realized that he made all his mistakes.
Yeah, he made all his mistakes, and he writes that at the end. Yeah, but it's too late. You know, sometimes when you've come to that realization, you know, as they say, it's verfallen, as they say in Yiddish. It's already a bit too late. It's good to find out beforehand. hindsight is 20/20. We know that, right? I'll leave it at that. But again, if you don't like this suggestion, as I said, please come to me with another suggestion. But as you see, very challenging over here. Thank God we've had 9 shiurim. We're almost on chapter 9. Cheated a bit in the last couple of chapters, but Mitzvah Shem will continue after the break. I really appreciate everybody's, particularly this semester, you've been very participatory, if that's the word to use. Everyone's been really sort of into the subject, and I've really appreciated that, and I look forward to continuing. Mitzvah Shem, thank you.